This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it's a varied conversation hour ahead. Good morning, everyone. I need your ideas today. What should I put inside my wall at home for future generations to find? I'm getting some work done and part of it requires building a fake wall. So before the plaster goes up, what should I do? Should I write my name? Write a message? What would it be? 1300 222 774. Have some fun with this. Have some fun with my renovations. Have you put something in a wall or a bottle or a time capsule? Or maybe you found something in your wall. Tell me about it. I'm lucky because through sheer chance, I locked in the cost of this work before the war and the cost of living hitting the construction costs. But maybe you've got renovation plans that are now looking a little bit shaky. So also this hour, we'll look at what is the first thing to economise on in a kitchen or a bathroom. Or maybe should we be shelving the renovation plans altogether, so to speak, until things settle down? We'll get some design tips, but I'd also love to hear your tips. What should you economise first on if you have to cut back on your renovations? Also this hour, how do we protect the people who protect us? How can emergency service workers protect themselves psychologically, physically, and how are we protecting them? I, of course, am talking about that recent horrific issue where we saw a off-duty, so to speak, actually, sorry, on-duty, but having a coffee first responder being assaulted. The state government, in response, has agreed to give mandatory jail sentences to people who assault first responders, no matter where they are, if they're off-duty or not. Will that work, though? Do mandatory jail sentences work? Is there evidence of that? Or are we kidding ourselves? Will it just make us feel better? If you're an emergency worker or your loved one is, we're going to be talking to people who are. We're going to take a fresh look at what first responders are going through in 2026. Also this hour, it caught my eye that the fat share prices of fast food behemoths are getting a little bit skinnier. Is that because of you? Have you kiboshed the KFC and ditched the Domino's? Is it about the cost of living? Or is it about the use of weight loss drugs? I want to examine whether fast food outlets can bounce back like two old beef patties, or are they starting to sail off under the golden arches? You let me know what you are up to when it comes to fast food, maybe how your habits have changed. Call and text me, tell me what I should put in my fake wall. But coming up next, how do we protect the people who protect us?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
I'm joined now by Erin McKenna, who is a paramedic, also a lecturer in the School of Paramedicine at Griffith University, also a student paramedic wellbeing support officer, so she knows all about it. Hello, Erin. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, what is it like to be an emergency service worker in 2026?
Well, I think it is a fantastic and amazing profession, and most paramedics feel honoured and privileged to do the job. But absolutely, there is a huge rise in our personal safety being threatened and our psychological health being affected by what we see and where we have to go and who we have to treat.
And I'm assuming because it is so random, this is something that must be very hard to prepare for psychologically.
Yeah, I think we do everything we can to prepare for that psychologically, and it starts at the university training level where we try to prepare graduates going out on road to be ready for what they see and what they may experience. But every day is different and we can't guarantee where we go or who we're going to see. And so I think there is that constant underlying anxiety and nervousness that today might be the day that something happens to us. It's very difficult to prepare for.
Have you been assaulted, Erin?
Yes, unfortunately I have. I've been a paramedic for 15 years, and both times I was assaulted were times that I could not possibly have prepared for. You know, it came completely out of nowhere, and me and my partner that I was working with were doing everything right and everything that we were trained to do. And yeah, unfortunately, those type of things still happen.
Do you think that people know enough or think enough about paramedic well-being outside of these moments when something horrific happens?
In terms of the general public, I think overall the sentiments that come back to me that are that people are, you know, aware of that paramedics see things that other people wouldn't normally see. And I think the public is generally very sympathetic and empathetic to what we go to. But it's impossible, I think, unless you're inside the profession to really understand the constancy of it, like that repetitive, every day, day in, day out, you know, being exposed to people's trauma, emotions, and then obviously occupational violence towards us as an industry. I think that's very difficult for people to comprehend when you don't experience it every day.
You're listening to Erin McKenna, who is a paramedic, also a lecturer, and helps out student paramedic in terms of their well-being. Erin, what do you tell your students? What's your sort of go-to advice when it comes to telling them how to approach the job?
To start with their mental health and well-being early. So day one in the paramedic program, we start trying to introduce lots of different psychological and physical safety tools and tips that we want them to start using from day one. Things like getting yourself a really good counsellor, you know, developing a relationship with a trauma-informed psychologist or trauma-informed counsellor early, and making sure that you're checking in with that person on a regular basis, whether you feel like you should or shouldn't, to avail yourself of things like peer support programs where paramedics help other paramedics to cope with the stresses of the job, psychologically and physically. Most ambulance services provide those, but we do at a university level as well. To focus on having really good family relationships and support for your family as well. And there's some amazing programs out there in Australia. Places like the Black Dog Institute and Fortum Australia are there to support families who have a member in emergency services, so getting those supports around you from day one, and then taking care of yourself physically as well so that you can compete with the demands of the job. So we do try to instill those things early so that they, when they head out there, they have a good grounding before they start being exposed heavily.
We're talking about this because of a horrific incident that happened when a paramedic was just having a coffee, but in uniform. What's the advice that you would give, or what have you started to do when it in terms of wearing your uniform?
I think you'll find that most services recommend that when you are not on shift, even going to or from shift, that you do not wear your uniform, given that these incidents are happening not just when paramedics are on shift, but also going to and from work. But, you know, in this case, and in many of the cases where paramedics are assaulted, they are on shift. They may not be actually treating a patient at the time, but they are on shift, so they're in uniform. We're expected to stay in uniform. We can't cover that up. So there are certain circumstances where that can't be avoided, and we have to be careful and really hyper-vigilant whenever we're in uniform, of no matter where we are, whether we're actively treating a patient or not, that we're conscious of our surroundings and who may be around us and our personal safety.
Erin, thank you for joining us and giving us some insight today into your important work, and thank you for all of your work.
Of course. No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Erin McKenna, a paramedic, a lecturer in the School of Paramedicine at Griffith Uni, and also a student paramedic wellbeing support officer. So we are talking about the state government that has responded and agreed to calls to tighten up the sentences for anyone who does assault an emergency service worker. There seemed to be a loophole that was concerning whether someone was on duty or not. But do these mandatory sentences work? What is the evidence? Do they, are they just there to make us feel better? And is that enough? I'm joined by Associate Professor Diana Johns, who's Chair of Criminology in the School of Social and Political Sciences. Thanks for joining me, Diana.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mary. Just to qualify, I'm actually not the chair anymore. I've handed that role over, but I am Associate Professor of Criminology.
We'll keep to that. Thank you for the clarification. With all of your experience, no matter what your title is there evidence that tightening up these and issuing mandatory sentences actually works?
There's not. I mean, first of all, I want to just acknowledge and thank Erin McKenna for all her insights and to acknowledge that the fear and distress and harm caused by violence is real, and it's something as a community we feel the need to respond to and for our governments to respond. All the evidence suggests that mandatory sentencing and mandatory jail sentences are not an effective response, however. It's based on this notion that deterrence works when there is overwhelming criminological evidence that that deterrence works only under tiny, very, very limited circumstances, such as, for example, if we're consciously driving along the road, you know, with our foot on the accelerator, speeding, and we see a police car and we stop speeding because we know that we're going to get caught. Limited circumstances such as that, deterrence can be said to work. But in the overwhelming sets of circumstances where violence is involved, or for example, in, you know, serious violence such as murder or homicide, all the evidence suggests that deterrence is not an effective response. If we think about the kinds of offences that we're trying to prevent when we're talking about violence against emergency service workers, for instance, that kind of violence is not associated with premeditated rational thinking. It's more likely to be associated, as Erin told us, with heightened emotion, perhaps with a trauma response, perhaps with drug and alcohol, the effects of drug and alcohol use, perhaps with deep mental health problems. As she said, we couldn't have prepared for it. The circumstances that emergency services workers find themselves and encounter day to day are often high risk encounters and high risk situations. These are not things that we can deter people from acting in a particular way from. And if we think about what a jail sentence is supposed to do, we have a sense that we need to be kept safe. If we think about what jail does, it does the opposite. It creates the conditions of more violence. It's like we can't punish people out of violence. What we need to do is to address the causes, the underlying reasons why people are using violence, and those come back to the things that I mentioned, that perhaps mental health problems, alcohol or other drug use. And I think what Erin emphasised was this needing to focus on mental health and focus on setting up conditions of care and relationships that hold us. These are the conditions that create safety.
Yeah.
Actually, prison is a short-term response that has enormous social and economic costs, and in the long term it doesn't create safety.
Right. So it doesn't create safety. 1300 222 774 if you'd like to join the conversation, or text 0437 774 774, because I'd love to hear your views. Diana, you must anticipate that there are people who would be saying, don't worry, I don't care. I don't care if it works. Just throw the book at them. Someone is saying on text, I don't understand the psychology behind someone wanting to hurt a paramedic. Why would you want to hurt someone who helps others? This as well, they're selfless heroes, these paramedics. They come to our aid. If you are a gutless scumbag who abuses or hurts a paramedic, you deserve a good flogging. What, in terms of community standards, that's just a really unscientific thing that I've thrown at you. But there is that element of just, well, we just want to make a stand, and there just has to be a principle, and we just need it to be there, even if it doesn't work. What would you say to that?
I would say we certainly need a swift and effective response. Absolutely. Because why would anyone hurt the people that are supposed to protect us? It is hard to fathom, and it is something that we want answers to, because we do need to feel safe in our community. However, I would also say we need to think beyond those first kind of emotional responses and think, what does keep us safe? And how does prison or mandatory sentencing work? It works in the short term to incapacitate somebody. But as I said, we can't punish people out of using violence. And if we imprison somebody and release them back to the street without actually changing anything about their behaviour, without addressing the causes of their violence in the first place, then we're not keeping ourselves safe in the long term. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the short term response is adding to the harm that we're causing. So I think if we just step back for a moment and think, what do we want in circumstances of violence? What do immediate victims want? And also, what do all of us as a community, as sort of secondary and tertiary victims, want? We want to feel safe. What creates safety? Safety is created through relationships and addressing the underlying causes of violence in our community. So, yeah
it still isn't what people are wanting, as you say, in that first instance. Diana John, so thank you for leaning into the conversation, a really important set of points to raise.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the opportunity, Mary.
That's Associate Professor Diana Johns from Melbourne University. I'm joined now by Professor Richard Bryant, Director of the University of New South Wales Traumatic Stress Clinic, and that runs the Black Dog National Emergency Worker Support Service. Thanks for joining us, Richard.
Good morning.
Tell me, what is your perspective on whether things are getting worse for paramedics in the work that you see?
If we actually look at the rates of mental health problems, they're probably not getting worse, but I think we're scientifically and in terms of public awareness just becoming more aware of it. It's always been a major, major problem. We know that rates of things like PTSD, anxiety, depression are much higher in our emergency service workers than the rest of us have to deal with. And it would really surprise most people what the levels of problems they do experience.
What's the main thing that Black Dog offers people in the emergency support space?
Well, this actually goes back to Black Summer. Such a long, protracted disaster that affected so many first responders around the country. The federal government actually set up the National Emergency Worker Support Service to provide a range of mental health services, including self-help, screening online, digital interventions, GP training, but also then a free and anonymous portal by which they could actually access expert clinical help from anywhere around the country. And that's been running ever since. And what was interesting is it's been renewed a number of times, because even though I think many people thought, you know, there'd be a short effect of Black Summer on emergency service workers, what we've seen is that that was just tapping the tip of the iceberg, and that we continue to get thousands and thousands of first responders coming for help very, very regularly, because they've got a lifetime of traumatic experiences they've been through.
Just to finish off, Richard, are you seeing that this is actually working with the expanded help and awareness, that this is helping people stay in the profession? Or are you seeing that it makes, while it might help them, we are still seeing people leave emergency service work because of this?
That's a great question. We know that if they come to our clinic, for example, we can sort of reduce PTSD in 80% of workers, which is a great response rate, some of the best in the world. Our big challenge is getting people to service before they leave active duty. We've got between 300,000 and 400,000 emergency service workers in the country, professional and volunteer. And so it's always a big challenge, and we're working hard to make sure that they can access us. And to be honest, the agencies are doing a great job in getting those workers to say, yes, I can get help whilst I'm on the job. I can deal with the problem so I can stay on the job.
Richard, thank you. Thank you for all of your work and your insights today.
Thank you.
That's Professor Richard Bryant from the clinic that runs the Black Dog Support Service for emergency workers. Chris says, still, Mary, anyone harming our emergency workers should receive a mandatory jail sentence. And yes, I'm seeing lots of texts talking about the assaults that people are getting, even as workers who work in legal aid, says someone on text. And what do we do about it? A lot of it has to do with the mental health. Keep those texts coming. I'd love to continue that conversation. Also, because it's Friday, I thought I'd get you to lean in on what I am going to be doing at the weekend. I've got a fake wall being put in the house. I wanted to get your tips on what I should leave for future generations. And John, you've called in from Maidstone with a suggestion. What do you think?
Yeah, g'day, Mary. I just thought I'd tell you our little story of what happened with us. Quite a while ago, we got some religious material delivered to our letterbox. And it was just a sweet little card with a beautiful little religious message on one side, and on the other side, there was the message, "Gob be with you." Obviously, there was a spelling mistake and it happened during the printing process. We had that kicking around our house just for a bit of a laugh, no offence to anyone, for about 6 months. And then we replastered one of the walls and we thought, let's just put it in there and see what happens in the future.
And you think the future generations might be thinking that we all, you know, worshipped Gob.
Yeah, or perhaps there was a different sect, the Gob sect, as opposed to the God sect.
Oh, that is fantastic, John. It did occur to me that I should mess with the minds of future generations. Should I? Should I? Let me know. Thank you, John. James, what do you think? Hi, James.
Yes. No, lovely day, isn't it?
It is.
I worked in an old building in the city. It's still in use nowadays, but there was little hidden spots around the place where building had been used for other things. And one of the hidden rooms, we found these clerks written on the wall, 1915, their names under it. And underneath that was, joining the army and we're off to the Great Wall.
Oh, wow.
When they wrote the Great Wall, they meant the just the war in Europe. But I don't think they realised how bad it was going to get.
Oh, what did that feel like, seeing that?
Because it's an old building, you see little things like that, but that one always stood out. And when we had to arrange the renovation of it, the person who was in charge of the building arranged for it to be covered up in such a way that if it ever got, the wall ever got moved again, it would come up again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, James. That would be fascinating work to be digging around and finding just those little scribbles. At the very least, I can do that. Brian in Brunswick, what have you found?
Well, I found a whole bunch of old cigarette packets, including the one that I sent in to you, which was...
See the photo.
Yeah. But there was a lot more. There was Craven A, there was a whole lot. And there were some various other things too, some very unusual ones. And, you know, because I'm in Brunswick and it was close to Coburg, it was very interesting because there was a four-page, very small leaflet which described ladies' lingerie that you could purchase from this shop on Sydney Road, long gone, but with illustrations as well. So, and that looked like it was done in probably the late 1920s or something like that. So,
yeah, wow, okay. And have you got any thoughts about what you would leave behind once you leave your house in Brunswick?
Well, no, I've got all the kids' signatures on one of the architraves for their heights as they all grow up.
Oh, yeah.
I had five kids. Of course, they're all gone now. But, yeah, you can go, look, well, there's Owen, and in such and such a year he was so many centimetres or inches. I might just leave that there for the future owner. But
absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Brian, thank you. These old houses, they really do contain the gems. What should I leave in my wall? I am going to also be talking to a design expert to say, am I going to ask him what he's maybe put in a wall? But also, with these renovations going on, if you have got a renovation that's looking a little bit dodgy because of the price that's just skyrocketed and maybe you didn't get your contract locked in, we'll be talking about how you can actually renovate during these times of crisis. But I still want to hear from you, what should I put in my wall through my renovations? Can I just say, I'm a little bit disturbed by how many texts are coming in suggesting I put in a plastic or fake skeleton. There's quite a few. I mean, a lot. Rob from Koroit says, put a fake skeleton in the wall, freak out the next renovator. Someone else says, a plastic skeleton holding a knife. I mean, yeah, why not? Are we reaching out to future generations or are we playing with their minds? This on text, my husband says to walk around the house, find all the odd socks and one left shoe and pile them into the wall cavity. Solves today's problem and creates a mystery for the future. What do you think? There's a few that talks about newspapers, of course. That would be interesting. Maybe they would be a relic by the time it came around. Yes, Rosie in St Kilda, I tend to agree with you. And this on text, might be cool to put something in the wall that might appreciate in value over time, maybe a special $2 coin or something like that. Yes, paying it forward. I love it. Join the conversation. What should I be putting behind the fake wall? Should I be sincere or should I mess around with future generations' minds? But also, how do we renovate? What should we compromise potentially if we are struck by cost of living crisis and all of the supply lines are going up in cost? What are the first things that we should compromise in our renovation plans?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
It's 11:30. I am asking you what I should put in my fake wall for future generations to find. 1300 222 774. Also, my heart goes out to everybody who is facing renovations in this time of soaring costs. Soaring costs of construction and the goods themselves. It made me wonder what are the first things that we should compromise in our renovation plans if we still need that renovation, but we just can't afford it. What are you economising on? 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or text 0437 774 774. I thought I should ask an expert. Don't ask me. Anthony Burke is joining me, Professor of Architecture and, of course, host of Grand Designs. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Mary.
Before we go any further, have you ever stuck anything in a fake wall for future generations?
You know what? I haven't. Now that you mention it, though, I'd really love to.
You've never been tempted. You've done enough renovations.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I'm thinking, you know, I've missed this opportunity. What was I thinking?
Okay, you'll go home, put a fake wall in just for the sake of it.
Just for this.
Yes. Now, have you been getting this feedback that a lot of people are having to start to rethink their renovation plans?
Yeah, absolutely. Having a few conversations recently on site with homeowners, both in Grand Designs, restorations, and the transformation space. So projects across the board are all facing different types of challenges. And it's amazing how quickly it's all hit. That's the thing that's kind of surprising, I think, all of us, really. It's as soon as the Middle East started to, you know, move in the direction that it's going in, those prices or those price changes flowed through very directly to us and had a major impact very quickly.
And so I'm thinking that the people who haven't locked in their prices, and maybe some who already have got the contracts, they'll be vulnerable to these price rises.
100%. So, you know, it's there are three stages, I suppose. If you're in the process of planning a project now and thinking about the kind of scope of the project you're looking at, yes, you're looking at a 30% increase on probably where we were 2-3 years ago. That's just kind of gotten now 1.2% more in just the last couple of months. So these are consequential numbers and they're changing fast, you know, and because we can't see an end to this, how long do we leave this kind of uncertainty open is a really vexing question for the construction industry.
Yeah, 30%, that's a lot. It's 28 minutes to 12. We are talking about renovation plans. We're also talking about what I should put in my wall. Keep those calls and texts coming. I'm going to get to some of them. They're pretty funny and frightening, a lot of them that are coming in. But also, Anthony Burke is here. If you've got a question about potentially what you could be economising on, give us a call, 1300 222 774. Anthony, 30%, so that's a lot. So that means that if you have to keep to the budget that you originally thought of, you need to compromise.
Yeah.
Would you say overall, if depending on what sort of room, what are the first things that you should be thinking about economising on?
Yeah, look, I think the general advice here is, and I would say this even without this kind of cost pressure, is we can probably take 20% off the amount of space that we think we need and still have a very, very good serviceable design. Actually, probably even a better design, because you're crystallizing the things that matter and getting rid of all the fluff that you think you need. Yeah?
So you're talking about those, the plans when you're building something like a big room at the back of your house. It can be 20%. Smaller.
Just take 20. Do the editing, right? Go through the plans and just try and get rid of 20% of the floor area, and you'll find that it probably becomes a better, tighter, stronger design because of that.
Oh, that's interesting. What about for particular rooms? For instance, a bathroom. What could you compromise on there?
Well, let's see. That's one of the hardest rooms, of course, in this moment, because it's so loaded with all the infrastructure. And so while you think of the fixtures like taps and shower heads and that kind of thing, really it's the kind of pipes and the behind the walls things that are really costing us the money. You probably might have already been talking about the fact that plumbing supplies, they were one of the first things to go up, you know, PVC pipes. And that flow through has been immediate. So, you know, how can you kind of economize on things like a pipe run or a plumbing layout. I mean, these are not interesting conversations to have from a design point of view at an aesthetic level, but they are really important from a cost and a functional sort of level. So, you know, yeah.
So in that sense, should we be leaving all that hardware alone and then trying to economise on that interior decorating part of it?
Yeah, I would say probably for now, if you can, leave the bathrooms for a minute, you know, maybe come back to them when the dust settles a little bit. Focus on the things that you can control. And what I'm seeing a lot of people do is reaching for the recycled, upcycled, reused kinds of materials. So if you're demoing something to then rebuild something like a back room or a back wall to add a room on, like all those bricks you took out of the back of the house, save them. You can reuse them. You don't have to pay for them. You don't have to transport them. And so much of the costs, of course, have flowed through from the transport costs. So if the materials are already on site, you're saving.
You're listening to Anthony Burke, who is Professor of Architecture and host of Grand Designs. We're talking about economising on renovations. We're also talking about what I should put in my wall. Emily from Newtown, you've got a suggestion?
Yes, Mary. I think it's a lovely idea for the history of the house if you put a photo in your wall of the house pre-renovation, and then the future owners will see the whole history of what it was like before and after.
Oh, that's a great suggestion, Emily, because I cannot figure out the provenance of some of the rooms in my house. I would love to go back in time. That's true. Have you done something like this yourself?
I am an architect, and so I really enjoy the history of buildings. So I would say to my clients sometimes, if you want to leave something, a photo is a really sweet idea.
That is a terrific one. See, Anthony, you've got an idea now. You're going to keep putting them in all of your renovations, aren't you?
Fabulous idea.
It is. So you talked about bathrooms, maybe leave that one. Similar case for kitchens, because I would have assumed, you know, there's a lot there that you can't compromise on as well.
Absolutely. And look, I think those two rooms, you know, this is going to be controversial, but I think people give them way too much kind of focus in a renovation because they are so laden with choices, you know, everything, again, from bench tops to taps. So, but the real spaces that you use, the ones that are, I suppose, the most important ones are things like the family spaces, the gathering spaces, you know, even the adjacent spaces in the hallway where you're kind of putting in a study nook or something. So you think about where you're spending your time as a family, you know, focus your attention there. We don't spend a lot of time in the bathroom. We go to town thinking it's some big spa experience, but it just doesn't have to be, you know, like it can be just a functional thing like it was back in the day, and put all that energy where it counts.
Exactly. We don't need the spa. Sometimes it's hard to let go of the dreams, though. Look, Gigi has called in with a suggestion for the fake wall. Or you, what have you done, Gigi?
We renovated our bathroom, toilet, laundry, and in the bathroom wall we put laminated photos of the previous bathroom, which was gorgeous beige tiles all the way to the ceiling, with a feature tile. So we put one of the feature tiles in. And then in the laundry, it had beautiful 70s wallpaper. So we took a piece of the wall and put it in a frame.
Oh, that's terrific. Did you put your name in there or anything else, or just these little clues?
Just little clues about the house.
About the house itself. Gigi, yeah just like we heard before, that's a terrific idea, isn't it, Anthony? Because I think we don't have, you know, apart from the old Google Earth photos, we just don't have that sense of what a house used to look like.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I've got an idea for your wall. Why don't you put in there a piece of music, something like something that you've been listening to right now that kind of gives you a timestamp, and you can put that piece of music on a CD or a floppy disk or something.
You might have to leave the player in there as well, just in case it gets obsolete before the wall comes down. We will get to more of the calls and excellent suggestions of what to put in my wall. But just to wrap up our conversation, Anthony, so you talked about potentially overall, should we be putting off renovations altogether? At the same time, we've heard that, you know, house prices or values are coming down, so there'd be many more people who are faced with that terrible choice of, look, I can't sell it for as much as I want to, but I do need more space. What sort of advice would you have to say to them about facing these uncertain times?
Yeah, it is a very uncertain moment out there. And I think, you know, having a little breath, if you can afford to, time-wise, if you can just take a moment and sort of say, hang on, can we sit on this for a second? Maybe, you know, reprioritize exactly what it is you're trying to achieve with your design. I think that's a really good thing to do right now, if you can. If you really need to move, you need to get going, then, like I said, focus on the just enough principle. What's just enough to achieve the aims that we're going for here? We don't need the big luxury thing. We just need the kind of the functional side of it. That can also be, of course, really beautiful. In fact, it's probably more beautiful if you think of it that way. So, you know, put the money where it counts. And I think the last thing is to maybe even rethink, can you share things? I mean, a lot of people are doing the share housing or the sharing the backyard or sharing something like a pool or a fruit garden, you know, like this kind of thing. Where are the opportunities for the sharing economy to start to come into your design? That's a really radical thought, but one that I really love the idea of.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I guess also it's about if you need to make your space feel better as well, it's those cheap things you can do in your garden or, you know, or around the rooms that actually make you feel better living in your space, even if you can't change it.
Exactly, Mary. That's perfect.
Yeah. this suggestion, Anthony, this is going to horrify you as an architect. Put a wall that leads to nowhere. That's what I should do. And also, Alan says, the renovation rule, if you can't see it, don't spend a fortune on it. According to Kath and Kim, you just need a veneer of monogamy.
And who doesn't want a veneer of monogamy?
And who doesn't want that? Anthony, thank you so much for leaning into our semi-serious only semi-serious conversation today about renovations.
Thanks, Mary. Good to talk.
Anthony Burke is Professor of Architecture and host of Grand Designs. Regina in Benalla says, we recently did a huge renovation of our home. I put a time capsule together to place under the floor. In it was an Aldi catalogue. Local real estate listings, the local paper and plans showing the renovation. I hope it will give future people a thrill. Thank you, Regina. I love that. There's a real mix of people who are being kind to the next generation and those who are not. I see the skeleton texts still coming in. Shane from the Riverina says, fake wall has to be fake nails. Yes, you could put fake anything behind there anyway, couldn't you? And Catherine in Geelong has sent me a photo of raunchy drawings and images in the wall of her house currently under renovations. I am looking at those. Some of those are magazine ads. Some of those are raunchy sketches indeed. Yeah, that's the thing. It makes you wonder what the motivation was, doesn't it? You'd love to think, who has done that and why? 1300 222 774. Tell me about your changed renovation plans or maybe what you would put behind a fake wall. Jill from Brunswick East says, I think old family photos with names and locations written on the back. Also add some pure wool insulation and wishes me good luck. Thank you. I might need that good luck with my renovations. And this on text, put a treasure map with puzzles and clues and ultimately lead them to your local McDonald's. Yes, that goes along the lines of, do we start a conspiracy theory? Do you do that? Is that how you start it? Just thinking what will happen down the track? 1300 222 774 is the number to call to join that conversation. But coming up next, something caught my eye. The shares of some rather large fast food companies have gone down. Now, is that a part of the normal ebb and flow of fast food responding to cost of living and different things that we might do in times of crisis, but then we'll bounce back once we've got our money back? Or maybe they are longer term. Maybe it's about the weight loss drugs that are out there. What is the future of fast food? Do you care? Do you want fast food to bounce back, like to all beef patties? Or will they deflate these shares and stay deflated like those day-old sesame seed buns? That's coming up next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
It's 16 minutes to 12. Well, what is happening with fast food? Is it going to bounce back or is it going to drift off under those golden arches? Here to help me figure it out, James Kirby from the Australian's Money Puzzle podcast, also, as you know, a regular with Raf. Thanks for leaning in, James.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. So what have we seen when it comes to fast food share prices?
Well, look, a lot of share prices were softer, obviously, over the last few months, since the Iran crisis. Broadly, share prices have been soft, and some of them have been considerably kind of going backwards. But yeah, the fast food companies here and importantly overseas on Wall Street have been knocked around considerably. So you get companies like Domino's. Now, sometimes there's specific issues with these companies, but Domino's Pizzas is down here. The retail food group, which most people wouldn't know, but they would know their brands, Glory Jeans, Donut King, etc. And they have all fallen fairly sharply on the share market. And there is a kind of talk that, yeah, you know, consumer sentiment is very soft, etc. So they may be suffering because of that. Though I think there's much more going on than that.
Yeah, we'll get to the reasons in a moment, but are these big drops overall? Like, how significant are they?
Yeah, no, they're significant drops, yeah. Like Collins Foods, which is the one behind Kentucky Fried Chicken in Australia, they are down around 25% over 6 months. So, you know, the market itself, the broader stock market is flat, basically, over the last few months. We'll be trending at around zero here at the moment so far this year. So, yeah, in relative terms and in absolute terms, they are weaker. And the same thing is happening in the U.S., where you've got those giant fast food companies, Taco Bell, et cetera, that would be a sort of, you know, backbone of retail portfolios traditionally because they were such dependable companies. They're called defensives. They're called defensives for a reason. They tend to defend investors when things are slow.
But no longer.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, there's part of the explanation, and like the kind of formal explanations that have been coming out from the companies, is that consumer sentiment is soft, and that's for sure. But the thing is that traditionally, the consumer sentiment doesn't traditionally knock these companies around to the same extent that it might say a luxury good company that was selling expensive clothes or shoes or something like that. It's called defensive because people traditionally, at least, don't spend much less on those sort of basic items if there is a recession or a recession-like atmosphere. So the question is there something actually different this time round, which I don't hear the companies talking about, but they wouldn't talk about it because it's not what they want to hear. And the issue is whether the weight loss drugs are really starting to make a difference to the economy itself.
Yeah.
And I think there's strong evidence that the weight loss drugs are. I'll just give you an example from another point of view, Chemist Warehouse. They had their annual results or half-year results just a few weeks ago. And the CEO explicitly pointed out how the weight loss drugs were boosting their sales. And they had they're having a very good run compared to the fast food companies.
Boosting their sales of the actual drugs?
Boosting the actual sale of the slimming drugs, the GLP-1 drugs. He pointed out that they had, not only were they lifting sales at Chemist Warehouse, but he said that Vikesh Rajamundar, who is the CEO, said that he thought this was not just a new category, but it was going to be enduring because once people start to use these slimming drugs, they'll use them. They're more than likely to use them for a long time, if not forever. So it's a really strong, from their point of view, it's a really strong sales category. But if you flip it over, it means that it's a really bad news for fast food companies.
Indeed, and all those domino effects. 1300 222 774, if this is resonating with you, maybe you're cutting down on fast food because of cost of living, but maybe it's about weight loss drugs. And is that something that will reshape our economy and reshape those share prices? This on text, the quality doesn't match the price for fast food anymore. And Shelley in Gippsland says, fast foods are revolting, overpriced, greasy muck. I much prefer to support and enjoy food from a local cafe, bakery, fish shop. I can't believe people still pay for it. So there is the weight loss drug part of it, but also do you feel, James, that maybe also the way we started thinking post-COVID and the lockdowns, it's all about supporting different outlets as well. It's in part about not going towards the fast food behemoths.
Well, Well, I think people would like to do that. And of course, I mean, most people would say yes. You know, you'd love to shop at your local bakery and have this sort of idealized view that there's a little vegetable shop and a little bakery. It's all very attractive. But the economics of it are pretty severe. And, you know, it's been shown regularly that, you know, what these massive companies with this enormous economies of scale, how cheaply they can provide food is extremely hard to compete with in any sort of boutique fashion or independent fashion. And that's a kind of law of economics that no one's going to get around very easily. So, you know, you might like to think so, and maybe COVID did change people's passions, and some people might be dedicated to that because it would require dedication really rather than rationally counting how much it costs, because the issue with the fast foods, of course, is that they're very cheap.
Mm. James, do you think that in the with the weight loss drug industry booming, that this is actually going to be changing the business models of these fast foods? I mean, that, you know, they'll want to survive. I'm not sure. I'm not on these drugs, whether, you know, the salads therefore are going to be more appealing, or whether that's just a part of our society that's going to get phased out.
Well, it's going to change the economy for sure, beyond doubt. I mean, as I say, it's going to cool off the attractions of fast foods. That's sort of like the front line of it. It's also going to boost the companies who make these slimming drugs. And by the way, when you think about Chemist Warehouse and talking about their sales being lifted by the drugs, that's in the injectable form. Wait until it becomes into pill form, and it's going to have a second boost. So it's going to change the economy in all sorts of ways. I'll give you an example, which is miles away from what we've been talking about. But in the US, they have done a little survey about the airlines. And the airlines are running their numbers and finding that the planes are lighter than they used to be on certain runs.
Really?
Because the passengers don't weigh as much as they used to, so they use less fuel. So you change the economics of the airline industry. So it extrapolates in all sorts of unlikely ways.
Oh, wow. And I guess, yeah, if I lost, you know, 5 kilos, I'm not going to put 5 more kilos of luggage in. That is fascinating. And I guess we're still waiting to see how that all shakes out over time and what happens with those weight loss drugs over time as well. James, before I let you go, in this hour, we've been talking about what we would put behind a fake wall. Question without notice. Have you ever put something behind a fake wall for future generations?
Behind a fake wall?
What would you leave?
That family photograph that you were very uncomfortable with your particular representation when everybody else looked okay. How about that?
Love it. James Kirby, thank you. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Mary.
James Kirby is from the Australian's Money Puzzle podcast. Maybe you should leave, you know, a copy of the podcast behind. Also, as you know, he's with Raf all the time. Janet, you've called in from Brunswick. Have you left something behind in your house?
Well, your conversation has made me think not so much about what I've left behind a wall in my house, but when I moved into a Victorian house back in the mid-80s, under the house was pages of a Women's Weekly magazine, which was really fascinating to read.
Yes, under a carpet in an old Brunswick house, actually, that we lived in, we ripped it up and found whole editions of something, I think, from the 1910s, and then we saw the other half of the room with 1940s, and so we got some sort of idea.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, actually, you have reminded me that that's happened as well. When we pulled up carpet, there's been newspapers under it.
Yeah, I think they must have done that as a matter of course. Janet, thank you. I love the old houses of Brunswick. Phil, you've called in. Have you got a suggestion for me? Hello, Phil.
Yes,
hello. Have you got a suggestion for me?
No, I was just ringing up telling you we found someone's, must have played a practical joke 81 years ago. We found someone's tools in the wall.
Someone's tools. Oh, dear. Do you think that maybe the person who was renovating just left them behind in the wrong spot?
No, I assume the house was built new back then.
Okay. What sort of tools were they?
Hammers, a jimmy bar.
Were they any good?
Oh, I'm still using some of them, yeah.
Right, you got free tools.
Yeah, and then some of the papers under the floor, under the carpet and liner were, because we had 4 layers of carpet.
Mm.
Carpet put on top of carpet, put on top of carpet.
They sound like really lazy renovations. Did you just keep thinking that you were going to get to the bottom and you just didn't?
Oh, when we started, before we pulled it up, we thought the floorboards were rotten. It felt really spongy when you were walking.
Phil, that sounds fantastic. Are you done with the renovations now?
I hope so. It nearly killed me.
I bet. Thank you, Phil. Yes, and wish me luck with my renovations. Yes, it's not really easy, but I still feel very lucky to be able to do it. Someone's asking, has anyone found a body behind a wall? Sounds like a movie plot, doesn't it? This from B in Melbourne. Idea for message behind the fake wall. Don't let the bastards grind you down. Oh, yes, it's good. It's a renovation pun as well. Love that, B. Marie from Ocean Grove would leave a checkbook in her fake wall. Al from Halls Gap says, when building our mud brick house in Great Western, we put heaps of random crap, I'm going to say it, in the walls. Beer bottles, glassware, newspapers in polypipe capsules, some cassettes of Kenny Rogers, plus more stuff. Good juxtaposition. That is hilarious. And again, many more sensible texts talking about putting photos of you in the house inside and out and on the street. As this has been Conversation Hour, thank you for joining me today and all of this week. I'll see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend and write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au.